the public, and also even to the city council members, Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Somehow they have ignored everything that we have said about our reasons for wanting a change, and that's what Santa Cruz needs, is a change. They need, as a matter of fact, to me, you know, this, with the exception of two city council members, I think all of the members of the city council need to be recalled, and let's get a change in this town, you know. These practices are inhuman as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's see what the audience thinks about this, if it's still awake. You awake out there, guys, gals? Phone number here is 427-3772. That's 427-FOLSC. Why don't you give a call to the studio and tell us, do you support Dan Hopkins' appeal of the permit of Community House? Is it a good idea? Should Dan give it up and, you know, spend the money somehow else? Or I guess you don't really have the money at the moment.
No, I don't.
Or do you want to donate money to this cause? Is it something he should do? Let's hear from you. 427-3772. Give him some input. Tell him what you think. He certainly heard some critical comments from some of his fellow campers. And I'm going to read you, as I say shortly, a letter. In fact, I'm going to read this while you're here, Dan. You can, you've actually read it yourself, I think. I showed it to you yesterday. Mm-hmm. But I think it's worth looking at. If I can find it, of course. It's always a question.
While you're looking for that, you know, one of the things that I noticed in city council meetings and commissioners meetings, zoning meetings, whatever, is that whenever anybody in the audience comes and gives a constructive answer to the problem, it is totally ignored, it's not even answered, and that just really blows me away. That's why I think we need a change in Santa Cruz, in the politics of Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I've been noticing that for years. The city council is masters of silence, particularly regarding oral communications, unless they, like Mike Rotkin, want to sound off to support their position, and then they do a little character assassination and then move on with ordinary business. Anyway, this is a letter that was delivered to me yesterday by Barbara Riverwoman, who is an activist for Save Our Shelters, and she actually included this letter to Scott Kennedy and another letter to me, which I'm not going to go into at this moment because she has some criticisms of me, which I intend to first discuss with her and then probably discuss with you. Wait, we have an incoming call. Perhaps this could be the first assassination threat, Dan. Hang on.
There you go. Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hey, am I on the air?
You are.
Hey, I don't want to be on the air.
Oh, you don't? Uh-oh.
Okay, Dan, take over. You're
uh-oh, okay. Looks like I'm going to be the host here for a second or two. Let's see, what do I need to talk about? One of the things that I noticed is when we push down people like homeless people or minorities or whatever,
you should be on the air, man. You sound good.
You end up in a situation where people turn to drugs and alcohol and crime because of their situation. Their lives are so miserable. They see no bright spot, no goals, no anything. And if we could only do something constructive for these people, empower these people, then we wouldn't have the problems. But one of the excuses that the rich uses is that the poor are taking all the money from everyone. Yet, how many poor people do you see that have big bank accounts? But the people that are saying that the poor are draining their money, they have the huge bank accounts. They're actually guilty of what you're telling other people.
Spoken like a poor man, Dan. actually, it was an interesting caller. He commended the talk about the need for positive solutions. And I indeed encourage people not merely to comment on Dan's plan to appeal the zoning board's grant of a permit for this 45-person community house property construction piece, but also to talk about anything else you want. Again, 427-3772 is the number, but right now we'd like to hear what you have to say about Dan's plan. Here's the letter to Barbara Riverman, from Barbara Riverman to Scott Kennedy, who is a city council member, previously a mayor. He's currently in the Middle East on some sort of a peace mission. Not quite sure what that is. Should be back in a couple of weeks. And I've frequently been a critic of his on the air, and will continue to be, I think, much to his chagrin, and apparently the chagrin of Barbara Riverwoman to some extent, or possibly not. Let's see what she has to say here. Dear Scott, writes Barbara, I want to respond to your comments at last night's city council meeting, but before I do that, I've been wanting for some time to thank you and Mike, next Mike Rotkin, the mayor, for taking the somewhat daring step of moving the campers to New Brighton. Although I suspect your motives were mixed, both humanitarian and strategic, it was far more than you were required to do. It started something that none of us would have thought of, and that has turned out to be an enormous blessing for 23 homeless persons. It was you and Mike at your best, responding in a human way to the appeals of the campers that Saturday, being creative and daring and cutting through red tape. I and the remaining 23 homeless persons are very grateful for that. I was upset last night at the remarks you made regarding the work of SOS, Save Our Shelters, which is the campers' rights organization that Barbara is a member of. I do not understand why we need to continue in these adversarial roles when we seem to agree on the need for emergency shelter in Santa Cruz and agree that a campground would be a viable solution. Sherry, that's Sherry Connable, who is also a spokesperson for the Save Our Shelter group, and I would like to meet with you as soon as possible to discuss how this work can proceed in a less acrimonious and more constructive way. The following are some of the issues that I think we need to talk about as soon as possible. Where we are now. It seems to me that many pieces of the puzzle are already in place, that there is the foundation to move ahead in a cooperative and constructive way. Here is the situation as I see it now. One, you have expressed support for an adequately staffed and properly managed campground, quote unquote. Mike, the mayor, has indicated that he is willing to consider an outdoor shelter if a site can be found and a carefully thought out proposal is submitted. Catherine and Celia, that's Catherine Byers and Celia Scott, two council members, as you know, are supportive of the idea of a campground. Two, we all agree that there is a shelter emergency in Santa Cruz and that this emergency will become particularly severe and visible on March 15th when the armory closes and when the River Street refugees will no longer be able to avail themselves of the state parks because of the beginning of tourist season. I'll have to ask Dan about that more later. Dan's getting a call on his pager. Feel free to call him, Dan. Three, Karen Gillette has indicated a serious interest in being the service provider for such a campground if her board were to authorize her to do so. She is willing to put together a full work-through proposal if there is some assurance that funds would be available. Four, Mike has indicated, the mayor, that money is available if such a campground were part of a comprehensive, quote, continuum of care model. Since there is clearly a gap in terms of emergency shelter in Santa Cruz, that is, there is presently no walk-in emergency shelter, a campground as a dignified and cost-effective piece of this continuum is certainly worth considering. Five, CCH, Citizens Committee for the Homeless, has expressed its formal support for the concept of a campground and offered to provide at least moral support in the search for an appropriate site. Six, we all share a major concern about the problem of alcohol and drug abuse and how this could be controlled. In working with the River Street refugees over the last 2 months, some of the answers to this tragic problem are beginning to seem clearer to me. I think there is a real possibility that something positive can emerge from the combined efforts of the Council, Citizens Committee for the Homeless, Karen's Program, that's Karen Gillette, who runs the Homeless Community Resource Center, and SOS, Save Our Shelters, in putting together a plan for a campground. But we need help, not continued attacks. I am pleading for more cooperation, understanding, and guidance from you, Scott. You are a key figure in this process, and without your positive role, the whole process could be crippled. She then starts into another major category, the role of grassroots community activists. I think we both agree that City Council depends on community activists to identify problems that need solutions, to bring these issues to the attention of the community, and to formulate solutions. The role of the City Council, as I see it, is to listen to the concerns of the community, to dialogue with the activists, and to work toward mutually acceptable solutions. I am hopeful that SOS can be seen as a group of serious community activists and not simply labeled as troublemakers. If this is not true, we need very specific help on how to go about our work in a more productive way. Then the next section, the relationship between SOS and Robert Morse. At last, my name appears in print. As you well know, there are some voices in the homeless advocacy movement that seem to derive a good deal of satisfaction from negative tactics and venomous personal attacks. And that has been as distressing to many homeless people and to Sherry and me, and as I'm sure it has been to you. SOS has criticized these tactics and refused to participate in them. As a result, we no longer work closely with people who work this way. We also acknowledge the sometimes useful watchdog role that Robert Morse plays, his intelligence in identifying and articulating certain issues, and his tireless efforts to make available the airwaves to the voices of the homeless. We have no control over whether or not he or others support our positions and in what manner they support us. I pleaded with you at the CCH 10th anniversary celebration not to identify SOS with Robert Morris and Chris Brazda. At that time, you acknowledged that your criticisms were directed at them and not at us. But in your subsequent criticisms, you seem to lump us together. I don't think this is fair to SOS. I welcome constructive criticism of our positions and our tactics, and I am more than eager to listen to and to learn from council members advocating for the homeless. Karen Gillette, for example, has been a wonderful resource in helping us understand more about the issues that confront us. Catherine Bowers and Celia Scott have both made helpful suggestions as to resources and procedures, but I get upset when we are accused of positions and tactics we have not only not used, but that we have actively opposed. The relationship between SOS and CCH. I have no desire to belabor the failure of CCH to successfully manage the Back 40. They never wanted to run a campground. They were overwhelmed, I'm sure, with simply trying to get Community House up and going. They simply didn't have the financial or staff resources to put together a successful campground. I think they would be the first to acknowledge that their good intentions ended in something of a nightmare, and that we were understandably eager to close it down and move on. I think that we all learned at least three things from the experiment. One, that homeless people themselves passionately prefer even a badly run campground to the overnight shelter model. Two, that to be successful, drug and alcohol rules need to be strictly enforced. And three, that the homeless need to be more actively involved in the decision-making and governance of the campground. I think that CCH may have unintentionally hurt the movement to get a permanent campground in Santa Cruz by not adhering to the latter two guidelines. If anything weakened the will of the community to proceed with the campground, it was the failure of the Back 40. I don't think SOS is to blame for this. I do think that some of us in SOS were either naive or in denial about the extent of alcohol and drug abuse on the Back 40. At this stage, SOS is eager to work cooperatively with CCH and has clearly separated itself from Robert Morris's and Chris Brazda's continued attacks on CCH. We support Community House, and we are happy that CCH is backing the idea of a campground for emergency shelter. I think we are both committed to the continuum of care model and see ourselves in complementary roles. Our request for a portion of the CDBG money was accepted in a friendly manner from Daryl Darling, who's the executive director of the CCH, or the Community House project, I should say. And I think there is a mutual feeling that it was appropriate to present reasonable options to the council for community deliberation. I thought Mike's characterization of this process as savaging each other's programs was a serious distortion of the reality. CCH voted at their last board meeting to actively support the concept of an open-air shelter and to seek that shelter by March 15th. Sherry and I would like to meet with you and Mike as soon as possible to talk about these issues and to begin more positive planning. I hope that you will view SOS as a community resource and not as a thorn in your side. And I hope that you will provide us with the support that will make our efforts fruitful. Please let us know if you're willing to meet with us, discuss the above issues, and plan for the future. Sincerely, Barbara Riverwoman. Copies to all council members, Daryl Darling, Karen Gillette, and myself, Robert Morris. Well, that's the letter from Barbara Riverwoman of SOS to Scott Kennedy, council member. And I'm reading it aloud because, Dan, you're here in the studio. You're one of the River Street refugees. You might say a renegade River Street refugee if you continue on this course you're on. Certainly not taking the position which the entire organization has so far taken. What do you think of this? Any comment on this letter that Barbara has addressed to Scott Kennedy?
Well, I have to take my hat off to her because she's doing what she thinks right is right, you know, and I understand what she's doing. She has been coming from a place of love all the way from the starting of this homeless situation at the Coral Street Shelter. I have to give her total credit. I admire her very much. The one thing that I think that I'm concerned with in all the activists involved is that each activist has their own way of doing things. And like, for instance, Robert Norris was a member of Save Our Shelters Committee. His name was up there as a core member. And somehow or another, he got worked out of that. And because he does things in his
way.
I've
never resigned. I'm still a member of SOS, as far as I'm concerned. But nobody ever calls me about the meetings.
But
actually, they haven't had a meeting in some time, I guess.
The thing that I'm trying to, you know, the thing that the way I see it is that all of us have our way of working on this homeless situation, and I think that we all should be on a united front rather than bickering amongst ourselves and eliminating people that don't operate the same way we do. I think it takes the entire group, all the activists, working together to accomplish our goals. This bickering and stuff has a tendency to just tear things apart and break down our strength and things. And actually, we need more support from other communities besides just the activists, the homeless activists. We need support from all minorities, any people that's been discriminated against, poor people, whatever, you know. People that understand these problems.
Well, there's a good question as to whether anybody's listening, because I want to remind you, in spite of my long-winded reading of this letter, which I'm going to comment on because I think it really points up some important issues. Nobody's called in to give them your opinion, or give an opinion of what you were saying, Dan, about this, should you be doing this appeal. So apparently nobody cares one way or the other, which is, of course, the worst of all possible worlds.
Well, actually, I did just get a call on my page, and I called back. I found out that it was a security telephone and at a place called SCO. And I think SCO
is operations.
I think that's real close to the Coral Street Shelter where this community house is going up. I'm pretty sure they have a building up there. And so there is a concerned person out there. I do wish that you would call the station. And the station's number is 427-3772. I have a feeling that you also, you must be supporting me in stopping the community house project because you're so close to the Coral Street Shelter. Please call back.
Are you supporting Dan, or are you telling him to give it up? Come on, call in, tell him what you think. You know, I believe in a united front too, although I also believe that there's a variety of ways to approach a problem, and sometimes a multiplicity of ways is a better thing than taking simply one road. I mean, different people have different approaches, and sometimes they complement each other and support each other, even in the, when they appear to be, to some extent, using very different means. The famous hard cop, soft cop analogy comes to mind. Activists who are very strident and critical can sometimes open the way for those who are willing to slip into the middle as mediators. That's a fact that Sherry Conable well knows. She did that number in 1990 in the summer when we had worked for years on establishing some kind of sleeping ban modification. We've been protesting, and I've been criticized for criticizing Sherry on what she did that summer, and I'd be happy to have any of a public discussion with her on this, and happy to mediate with her on this. It's an issue that I think is an important one, but certainly more important than any issues between us in this is to get the sleeping ban modified or repealed. To make it legal for people to sleep, not necessarily sleep on everybody's doorstep, downtown, in the streets, no, but to sleep in legal places. So there are legal places where people sleep who need to sleep. And obviously a campground is a major need as well. I mean, in a way, that's not disputed. The question then starts to come down to what should be done, what kind of appeals should be made to the community and to the council. And the appeal of Barbara, of course, is for cooperation, is for mutual respect. And she also criticizes Councilmember Kennedy for pointing out that she was upset at remarks that he made, that kind of linking her with me in terms of comments I made, which she did not share in, and indeed she has a perfect right not to. The question, though, is when they don't respond, or when they respond negatively, what do you do next? Do you turn around and blame the vitriolic voices and kind of nestle in more closely and coo more softly to the city council members? I mean, is that, who knows? I mean, I'm though I've been doing this for a decade, I don't really know the answers. And in a way, I guess it depends to some extent on your temperament and your judgment of the situation. And Barbara Riverwoman and the has always felt, I think, that she's a Gandhian. And she believes in nonviolence deeply in her soul, and treating even her most intransigent and what I would regard as unreasonable opponents, even duplicitous opponents, with great respect. And there is, of course, something to be said for that, and I have some real respect for that. My position has always been somewhat different. I feel that if someone's acting like an asshole, you call them an asshole. And if that is called name-calling, then the name should be noted, and the criticism should be if the name is incorrectly or inappropriately applied, I guess. I've never been a great deal of a diplomat around this issue. I don't claim to be, and I guess I do raise the issues. And I suggest some solutions, but before the solutions even begin to be worked out, the problem has to be acknowledged and the support for a change has to be seen. And really, that's what we need in the month ahead, support for a change in the situation. I mean, it's been an issue I've been ragging about all winter, but we need the support of you and the audience to continue to breathe down the necks of the city council on the issue of the sleeping ban and the right to have a campground. And frankly, in my own specific way, I'd say that if Dan is pressing on with this appeal, then I would encourage you to support him, if only for the fact that the issue of open space and city council collusion in destroying that open space, I happen to feel that if you embarrass them around the issue, they are put in a position where they have to respond. That, of course, is my call on it. The other call is that you don't want to embarrass them, you want to give them a way to save face, and in so doing, because they fundamentally share your views, they will find open air shelter. I've not been convinced that that's likely to happen, and I've been sitting with two of the much more sympathetic council members, Celia Scott and Catherine Byers, for 4 months on their open air shelter subcommittee. You know, they do not seem willing to take independent action. Now, maybe it's a matter of waiting and waiting and waiting until the final straw breaks the camel's back and they turn into, tigers. And indeed, Celia Scott impressed me a great deal at the last council meeting by actually beginning to say things that I wished she'd said months and months ago about the Citizens Committee for the, not Citizens Committee for the Homeless, about the need for money to be given to save our shelters. But they're still timid. And that depresses me. What else have we got here? Well, there are a couple things I disagree with here. I don't think the campground was a failure. What do you think, Dan? Was the campground a failure? You're not exactly a drunkard and an alcoholic yourself, are you?
No, actually, I'm a sober person. I have 15 years and 3 months of sobriety one day at a time due to some 12-step programs and things. And as far as the Cole Street shelter was concerned,
This, by the way, is the only legal place to sleep in Santa Cruz, and was the only open-air shelter in the nation that we had heard about when Paul Marceau and Daryl Darling violated the word given by the two of them and closed that property down on December 12th, and was finally closed, I guess, on the 18th.
Actually, the Cole Street shelter would have been very successful if that place would have stayed open. I had gotten a job within 2 weeks. I used the facilities there because they let us have an address and telephone number and receive mail there. And so within 2 weeks of getting at the shelter, I was able to get a job because I wanted to be like somewhat of a normal person if I could.
Well, why does Barbara say it was a failure? I mean, I wish we had her in the studio. She's told us repeatedly that she may be coming in at some point. I'm hoping she will. Maybe she'll come in next week, she says, and she has, I guess there's a, Sherry Connival has a birthday today, which the campers are celebrating, and by the way, if anybody wishes to, they can give contributions to the River Street Refugees at 425-5939, which is Barbara Riverwoman's number, and I believe they still need firewood?
Yeah, we definitely need firewood. I think we only have like about 5 pieces left out there. We're at New Brighton Beach right now.
It's New Brighton Beach State Campground, right south of Capitola, or actually kind of on the south edge of Capitola. But I'm sorry, again, asking you, Barbara Riverman says the campground was a failure. I'm going to see if I quote her exactly correctly. The failure of CCH to successfully manage the Back 40.
There it is.
We know that they failed to successfully manage it, but they said they didn't have the financial or staff resources to put together a successful campground. They'll be the first to acknowledge their good intentions turning into something of a nightmare, and they were understandably eager to close it down and move on. I think we learned 3 things from the experiment. Maybe I'm misquoting Barbara. She may not be saying that the campground was a failure, but rather, in her own diplomatic way, saying that CCH failed to run it properly.
That's exactly what the reason is, because it was so unreal. Like after I got my job, what I was telling you about, we would go in Maybe one day they would say, okay, you got to take your tents down in the morning, because they had a thing there where you had to take your tents down in the morning, leave them down, and then at night you could put them back up. But on a day-to-day basis, they had no consistency whatsoever. And because I was working and everything, I never knew what to do from day to day if I hadn't been, if I wasn't there all day and I came home late at night.
The problem they had, of course, with that was, to some extent, that the city council had mandated this, and then, of course, the campers got together and said they wouldn't do it because it was inappropriate and, inhumane, and also discriminatorily enforced. But I guess I found that the sentence, she doesn't just say that they failed to run it properly. She says, if anything weakened the will of the community to proceed with the campground was the failure of the back 40. I don't think SOS is to blame for this. I do think that some of us in SOS were either naive or in denial about the extent of alcohol and drug abuse in the back 40. The failure of the back 40. See, that phrase makes me worried. That phrase kind of chills me. Is that an appropriate phrase? Would you agree with that?
Actually, if there was any failure involved, it was because of mismanagement, because they didn't follow their own policies. If there was some serious troublemakers there sometimes, alcohol, drugs, or whatever they were doing, it was because they didn't follow their own policies, and one day it was okay to be drunk for some people, and other days it wasn't, and so they just really didn't have, I know that these people wouldn't be able to live in a highly structured situation, but they should have had some structure there in the back and some rules, and so that we wouldn't have all these problems that we had back there, making everyone believe that the phone's ringing, by the way.
Hi there, you're Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Appreciate your not identifying me by name in this segment.
Okay.
Why don't the cops have done something real simple back there, which is to get a background check on all the employees who are employed by Ms. Gillette and whoever hired the staff back there? Because I had complaint. Eyewitness complaint say there was a lot of drugs going on, that the heroin and coke was being sold into tents that had become, and simply doing a background check on the personnel who would be responsible for discovering that, Now, certainly somebody who comes up, who was a resident, who told me, yes, the tents were closed, privacy was being used as a cover to do major drug deals there. Now that's enough to get a warrant to go and search some of those tents, That's enough. But apparently very simple things aren't done. The police don't do very simple things like get background checks on the employees of the ISSP.
Hmm.
Now, another interesting fact.
Can I comment on that part first?
Sure.
Well, I'm not a big partisan of the drug war, I gotta tell you, whether it's against people in houses or people in tents. And I am a partisan of, I'm against drug abuse, and I'm against the victimization of people, either because you got a bunch of drunken folks running around doing so, or you have people stealing things for their heroin habits. I mean, that certainly I oppose. But I'm a reluctant to get on the bandwagon of, somehow feeling that homeless people with more problems should be held to a higher standard than our society generally, and I don't believe that people dealing drugs generally should be arrested and jailed. I mean, I really don't. I think that
dealers should not be arrested.
No,
people
I don't think
who
so.
Deal heroin and cocaine.
You
should
got
not.
It. I favor decriminalization of drugs. I think doing that produces a whole situation which produces simply another of a bunch of dealers, raises the price of the drugs, produces a war, a shooting war, and a state.
You think that that known dealers should not be arrested and jailed?
Yeah, I
okay.
do.
I think that's actually what is already the status quo, not only in this town, but in a lot of other towns. We're about in all the towns in the country, practically.
Now, I make exception for the
status quo is that the largest dealers are known.
I make exception for the CIA. I think the CIA should have been jailed long ago, but that's a special exception.
Yeah, the largest dealers are known to the DA, to the police, who cover that area. And the worst thing you wonder is how the police that cover the drug area, the drug infested area, like the Beach Flats, and which is completely owned almost by Canfield, whose drug dealers litter the street by his name leading to his attraction, his cotton candy gravity machine attraction, which brings in 30, 40,000 people every day in the summer who are potential drug customers. And I think it's clear that not only in this city, but in many others in which, especially in a tourist-town attraction, that the dealers, the largest dealers, are known. And that's it's the fact that people like this Mark Tracy, the sheriff, and this woman running for the Board of Supervisors.
Susan Hart?
She's in the paper today.
No, I'm not sure. There are a number of them. But, you know, my comment...
Let me finish a thought.
All right.
If I can, I'm looking for the article also.
Uh-huh.
Can't find it, but the woman is for the curfew because it looks Brandy's. Good to get the police to direct their attention at people who may be 15, 16, 17, who are for some reason illegal because of age. And while the police are making this high-profile effort to keep these people from either doing small amounts of drugs or apparently graffiti or just illegalizing their existence outside, I guess preparation for criminalizing them, 30% of them will become entangled in the criminal justice system, and they'll go into that jail where half of them are in jail now for self-victimizing crimes of drug addiction. And this is on a public front in order to keep the attention focused on the smallest and least harmful of the drug economy. Drug economy. There's a huge drug economy in Santa Cruz.
You got to get to respond to this. So.
Well, all the big drug dealers get completely away scot-free.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think the solution to that is going after big drug dealers, because if you go after big drug dealers, you're gonna be other big drug dealers who take their place because it becomes even more profitable.
No, that's the status quo. That's why the large drug dealers, once they become known to the authorities, are just left alone because they figure, oh, well, as long as it's confined to a certain geographic area, that area's degraded, and that's it, and we'll live with that.
The solution is to do as Lee Cornstrom, ironically enough, and William Buckley both recommend, which is to decriminalize drugs.
Yeah, but they only want to do that because they just as soon as poor people kill themselves with drugs.
Well,
I want to do is decriminalize the addiction to drug, but I do not want to decriminalize dealing. Dealing should be illegal, and the largest dealer should be attacked first.
Should selling alcohol be illegal?
Excuse me?
Should selling alcohol be illegal?
Should selling alcohol be illegal?
Yes.
No.
Alcohol is a more dangerous drug than heroin or cocaine. It kills more people per year by a magnitude of 100. So should we do the same thing with alcohol? Tobacco is even more deadly than alcohol. It kills even more people than alcohol.
Tobacco is extremely deadly. A 1,000 people under age of 20 begin smoking a day.
Right,
and 1,000 people in their 50s and 60s die of asphyxiation.
Should it be criminalized?
No.
See, there we agree. Why do you differentiate with cocaine and heroin?
Because cocaine and heroin are so addictive. They're addicting the first time. They are so addicting, and it's so easy to entrap people in using them. The police are even assigned the function to entrap people. Whenever there's a few cells in the jail and they spend $10 million on the jail, we say, Mark Tracy said on 71 last week, we spend $20 million total, $10 million of it on the jail, and half of the people in the jail are there for drug addiction, and the police are charged with going out and trapping them for addiction so that they can keep their jails full. Now, this looks all good from a public perspective point of view, from a media point of view. All these Mark Tracy, he doesn't look sinister at all. But the sinister people may not even look sinister. Are the people who own many of the businesses, the drug money, the $200 billion a year in heroin coke money over the 10 years that it's been going on big time. You know, big time, since crack especially, own a substantial portion of the real estate in the country. They own and they funnel this money and they recycle it and they launder it and everything.
Yeah, I'd love to have some specifics on this. And
so those people who bring people addictive substances in large quantity should be the first priority of law enforcement to jail, not the hapless victim who's simply 1101. I would
actually agree with you, although I would go further, and I would say that I think you've got to change the resources that you're putting into criminalizing the importation of the drugs and putting them into treatment centers and education. I think you go a lot further in dealing with the problem. That's just my thought. But I know that Dragon's Heart Dan has recognized your mystery voice, which I suspect numerous other listeners have, and I'm not going to identify you because you've asked that I not do that. But he wants to have a word with you off air. Is that a possibility?
Sure.
Anything more you want to conclude with before we take you off air?
No.
Thanks.
So that's an issue, certainly, which, you know, is what I've been ragging on for a while. What I'm going to try to do now is move on to a couple of other quick topics, kind of updates that hopefully we'll be able to rattle off before we get to the end of the show. I got updates here. What have I got here? Let's do kind of a brief update from Santa Barbara. You know, I worked in Santa Barbara as a homeless advocate for about a year. I was actually arrested at the Santa Barbara Armory for challenging their refusal to give homeless people hot water. And that was about, a year ago? No, that was 2 years ago. 1992 at Christmas is when I was hauled away. But we finally got the hot water turned on at the Armory. We had the same kind of problems we were seeing at the homeless shelter out at River Street. I should say the Coral Street Open Air Shelter. They had porta potties that were overflowing and not being emptied. They had staff that were thugging about and getting discriminatory privileges. We had activists who were being excluded. Although I should say that, again, this did not happen. Actually, hadn't begun to happen until the Citizens Committee for the Homeless excluded me from its board meeting last Thursday. Then we began to see the exclusion of activists here in Santa Cruz rearing its ugly head. But we had that problem in Santa Barbara in 1992. They ran us out of the Armory. They had us arrested for being there until we just, you know, we had to keep coming back in. They roused people against us, shouting we were trying to close down the Armory. We were endangering their programs. Same cry that was raised against me and others in 1992, and we challenged the quality of the food, the free meal, and we asked for protections for activists in that program back then. And this year, I said things have been much better here in Santa Cruz for the last couple of years, actually, and I'm pleased and impressed with that. But I've got a clipping from Santa Barbara. Homeless can't escape the cold, 20th of January, 1996. Night conditions worsened at the Armory, and I see my favorite stomping ground, the Santa Barbara Armory, where I was surrounded by people who were threatening to beat the shit out of me. And indeed, Gandhi looked pretty good at that point, and that's what I did. I sat down and said, well, you do what you gotta do. And actually, we were able to change that condition, even though I was arrested for disturbing the peace by giving out literature which the people who were running the Armory felt was going to close it down. They revealed that the fact that they weren't emptying their toilets, that they weren't allowing people access to the restroom, and similar things. And we were able to cause some changes, again, through raising the issues loudly. Here's what the story, however, says. It's from the Santa Barbara News Press by Pamela Lopez Johnson. Well, they don't expect the Biltmore. Homeless lodgers at the National Guard Armory in Santa Barbara say the conditions there are becoming unbearable, even for the standards of the street. There has been no heat at the nighttime shelter since the beginning of the year. Each of the approximately 150 nightly guests who get a cot are allowed only one thin blanket. Those who sleep on the floor get two. To make matters worse, there are too few blankets to go around, and the ones that are available have not been laundered since the Armory opened for the winter on November 22nd. On Thursday night, the lodgers that filed into the shelter at 700 East Cañon Perdido picked through a large heap of the gray blankets made up of 85% recycled wool. Putting them to their noses, they said they were rummaging for ones they deemed least offensive. But some, such as Virginia Kilgour, said they would rather go without. She said she has slept in a cot without a blanket ever since she found one covered with tiny bugs. Then one recent night, it got so cold that she gave in and asked for one. By that time, they had all been taken. Some of the people here don't smell too good, but the blankets could gag a maggot, said 40-year-old Alan, an unemployed construction worker who asked that his last name not be printed. Although he wishes they were cleaner, he foregoes sleeping on a cot so he can be allowed two blankets. It's miserable when it gets below 40 degrees in here, he says. Some lodgers who arrived shortly before midnight when the Armory closes its doors for the night said they are given plastic garbage bags in which to sleep when the blankets run out. Shelter manager Robert Earn said he is working as quickly as possible to correct the problems. Earn works for the Salvation Army, which runs the shelter during the winter months. The building is maintained by the state, but the county covers much of the cost of the supplies, such as blankets and any damage caused by clients. Earn said the blankets cannot be laundered because the material is too thin to survive a washing machine. The most soiled ones are discarded, he said. Further, lodgers often steal blankets, causing a major shortage. I'm frustrated about it too, Earn said. I can't explain why it's been so hard for us to get more blankets. Sharetta Gerard, Director of Human Services, Division of the County Health Care Services Department, said the reason is it's so difficult to replace the blankets boils down to money. When funds are available, she and her staff are hoping to get more durable blankets which can hold up in a washing machine. It's a difficult situation, Gerard said. We are making do with limited funds available. I don't think the Gerard is sleeping in those blankets. Gerard said she's been working with state and army officials to get the heater repaired. We are fortunate that we haven't had the cold and rain like last year, she said. We are certainly putting our very best effort forth. Sergeant Wayne Smith, who oversees supplies at the Army, said state maintenance workers are in the process of repairing the heater's fan that malfunctioned. The industrial metal heater was built in 1936. When it gets that cold, you have to expect it to break down from time to time, he said, adding that he expects it to be in full working order by early next week. And this clipping was from the 20th of January. I don't have a clear update on that yet. But there are other concerns. For instance, the men's bathroom has been out of order for the past month, and on Tuesday and Thursday nights, volleyball players use the facility until 8 p.m. It's interesting, volleyball players displacing homeless people from coming into the armory. It's the same kind of argument that was used against a campground here in Harvey West Park in Santa Cruz because sports problems, or against using the benchlands for an emergency campground because there are occasional fares on the benchlands. The priorities are bad, very bad, and it's disgraceful to hear people use these kinds of arguments in groups concerned with homeless services and rights, even though, in some extent, they're talking about the politically possible. On the nights when volleyball players use the Santa Barbara Armory, lodgers must wait outside, sometimes in the rain, until 8:30 at night. Nobody is fond of waiting outside, acknowledged Earn, but there's nothing we can do about it. How about telling the volleyball players to skip their games for the duration? They could do that, couldn't they? Gerard said the state is being called upon to fix the plumbing under the men's bathroom and the rest of the old building. Unfortunately, the facility suffers from a chronic maintenance problem. She said maybe it's a chronic indifference problem. Moreover, as owners of the building, the National Guard has the right to rent the facility. She said the situation with volleyball players using the building has improved over the years. In the past, the volleyball teams had no set hours. Then lodgers would never know how long they would have to wait for the doors to open. Santa Barbara, it's a richer community even than Santa Cruz, and they actually had a more active homeless rights movement for a long time, and they abolished their sleeping ban because people threatened to come to the city in mass and sleep out. And in 1986, they abolished their ban. Might be said, however, that in 1989, it was reestablished, not because there was such a major problem, but because a reactionary judge found a code section that allowed that to happen. And the beat goes on. So Dan here is still in the studio waiting for your flood of calls, and the number is 427-3772, in case you want to talk about his plan to appeal the community house permit, which... Dan, let me ask you a question about that. Isn't it fair to say that... I just saw a tape here from Phil Free, Just Kidding's Moral Compass. That's we'll go out on that music, I guess, in this hour. Isn't it true that you really, a lot of your objections, I'm wondering, I mean, you talk about the toxic situation and the, you know, rebarb and noise and such, and certainly all those things are true, but if all those things are true for, you know, as an argument not to have community house trailers, then certainly they're true for 200 people in a campground. I mean, wouldn't you also agree that opening up a campground there or continuing that campground over the winter would be equally disastrous to health? And people would be even more exposed to these things in a campground, wouldn't they?
In that particular campground, they probably would be. I was in hopes that if they followed through with the community house, that they would have also an open-air shelter in another location that was healthy, and there would be no reason why Citizens Committee for the Homeless couldn't run an open-air shelter and community house. which would actually even give them more power, if you want to look at it in that sense, you know. They would be able to get finances for both.
Yeah, but Dan, is this some new revelation? I mean, I thought I heard these same arguments coming from you last December about the toxic nature of the area, and yet you favored keeping the campground open through the winter. I mean, are you favoring consigning campers and homeless people to noxious living conditions? I mean, was that what you were saying? You want everybody to share your cough? You think people should live in these wretched circumstances? What is your argument?
Actually, no, I don't think that they should live in that, but... based on what alternatives we had no alternatives, and the people that were living there actually would rather stay under those conditions, taking the risk, the health risk and everything, just to have a safe place to sleep and to try to get their lives together. As I have mentioned before, I got a job and everything, you know, and I would still be working there if it hadn't been for all the turmoil that came around the Coral Street shelter. I probably wouldn't even be homeless right now.
I mean, the turmoil because the campground was, as Bob Riverman called it, a failure, or because the Citizens Committee was insisting on closing it down and scaring people right and left every few weeks.
It was because of the constant fear of not knowing from day to day if we were going to be there, if we were going to come back, and all our things were going to be missing, we were going to be arrested, we were threatened with being arrested, and all sorts of things, you know. And I don't know, I feel that the homeless people were not empowered in any way, and me appealing this is just an act to empower homeless people, to show that they do have some strength legally, you know, to oppose inhumane treatment and discrimination, and hopefully strike down the sleeping ban. That particular place is unhealthy.
What do you say to the particular, well, are you, two things. First, what do you say to those who have said, as I said, like two or three weeks ago, that because the contract with the campers was violated by those property owners, because the campers should have been allowed to stay on that property, and indeed should still be allowed on that property, and if you're appealing, then that permit has not yet been granted, and that whole period has to be extended until 10 days after February 27th, which I believe is the next city council meeting. I'm not quite sure. It's the fourth Tuesday in February. The agreement made by Paul Marceau, Citizens Committee for the Homeless, head of the Open Air Shelter, with your campers group, as I understand it, mm-hmm. was that you'd be allowed to stay at the Coral Street Open Air Shelter property in your tents, on top of your pallets, right next to the emergency services, which included